And for those of you that are new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial for how to use this podcast. When you hear the bell ding, that means that you should look on your device to see what paper we're referencing to back up what we're saying. But if you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether or not you want to take it or leave it. Welcome to 2010, everybody, and welcome to the January episode of AZMcast. I know we've talked a lot recently about MRI and the ED, and we've used it to branch off even more into a philosophical discussion of diagnostic uncertainty. Well, we're not done yet. Well, we are, like me and Jared and Brian and Chris, like we're taking a break. But we are fortunate to have some of our alumni from our program, Dr. Clay Giuseppe and Dr. Mike McLaughlin, give their peer review. They gave us an amazing peer review on ACLS last year, and they were so good and so well received by you, the listeners, that we asked them if they would come back. And their peer review this time around on diagnostic uncertainty is so insightful, so poignant, so, what's the word I'm looking for? Better than our opinion, that we gave them their own episode. And to make it even sweeter, we have an opinion from the man himself, Dr. Peter Rosen, at the end of the episode. So enjoy a break from our whiny voices and get ready to listen to how some real doctors deal with diagnostic uncertainty in the emergency department.
Hey guys, this is Clay Giuseppe and Mike McLaughlin up in Tahoe. Coming back to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks again. We really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to do this. My name is Mike McLaughlin. You heard from Clay Giuseppe. Clay graduated in 2010. I graduated in 2008, a couple years before. I did have the distinction of being Clay's attending for 1 year. So we're going to talk this month about MRI and diagnostic uncertainty. Quickly before we proceed, I want to give a quick overview of our practice. We work in community medicine, private democratic group. We live in Lake Tahoe, California. We staff two hospitals. One is a small to perhaps medium-sized community hospital.
20K visits.
Yeah, 20,000 visits a year, roughly, a few more nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, we get a lot of tourists. We get a lot of trauma related to ski hill injuries. And then we also staff another much smaller emergency department, you know, about 11,000 visits a year or something like that.
Critical access hospital, very rural.
Single coverage, a lot of elderly patients, a lot of nursing home patients at that hospital.
The overall summary, just to be concise, is this is pretty core community emergency medicine in the United States. Small facilities serving spread out communities with a little bit of a catchment area and single coverage. I think a lot of people are practicing that environment in this country.
Yeah, we do not have a lot of specialty care. We transfer a lot of our patients, especially the most critical patients or ones that need subspecialty care. So quickly, I wanted to touch on MRI, just some nuts and bolts here before we proceed, because we want to talk more about diagnostic uncertainty, which I think is a more interesting topic. We wanted to philosophize for a bit. At one of our facilities, we do have daily MRI from basically banker's hours, roughly like 8 o'clock a.m. to 7 p.m. In the other facility, it's only Monday through Friday, and it's really about 8 to 4. So you got to catch it during the day.
Well, it's 4:30 actually, but I ordered one at 4:14 yesterday and the tech was gone.
Never fails. Quickly about MRI here. Number one, don't expect that kind of availability to MRI when you're done. I have never ordered an MRI of the chest or abdomen from the emergency department. I do think that MRI will become generally more available as the years goes on. It's going to become cheaper. It's going to become more accessible. And I think if it were more accessible, I would use it more. But I don't think I would be ordering it for things that elective cases. I'm strongly in favor of not doing MRIs on elective cases that can get done as an outpatient. I'm against having it done for convenience. It really, really slows down the department. And I speak from experience. Yeah, you know, small little delays here and there just add up downstream. It's like a traffic jam.
What's going on with MRI and ED in a small community hospital? That's what we want to let you know.
So stroke, first and foremost, I think is the most powerful use of MRI in our setting. Mm-hmm. For these unclear cases, vertigo of unclear etiology, this isn't the patient with an obvious big stroke. You know, if you need to rule out a stroke, I think MRI is incredibly useful because I can't get a neuro consult in our emergency department. We do not have neurology at either place.
Yes.
Yeah, so you just got to figure it out. And the MRI is really great for that in these unclear cases. I think it is also incredibly useful in TIAs.
Yep.
You know, if it's available, I think you can stave off an admission. If somebody's not in AFib and they're in sinus rhythm, you get an MRI of the brain, an MRI of the neck, and you've risk stratified them as far as their carotid flow goes. And, you know, the only question after that is, what do I send them home on? Do I send them home on aspirin or Agrinox or Plavix? And that's a question you can have with a neurologist. And that's an easy question to have after you've done the MRI and the MRA.
Yeah, once you have the results of that study, you actually have something to base your plan on. So you can actually send that patient home and give them like a safe follow-up plan. When else do you use it? Obviously, when it's indicated, somebody comes in with a fever and, you know, bilateral lower extremity symptoms, that's a different story. But in terms of just using it to address your own sort of diagnostic uncertainty to influence your disposition, for me, it's mostly vertigo and TIA.
I don't use it for these elderly insufficiency fractures in the emergency department because it doesn't change disposition.
Yeah.
I will use it for occult hips. You know, the elderly person who falls, they can't walk, the x-ray is negative.
If it's banker's hour.
If it's banker's hours, I go right to the MRI. If not, I get a CT scan. Because you got to figure out what's going on in that patient. They're probably not going to go home anyways if they can't walk. But, you know, you need to understand what the next step is. And I do find myself using it to risk stratify diabetic foot infections if I have it available. Those patients are all getting admitted. I'll do it during the day if it's available.
Yeah.
But I completely agree. I don't want to slow down the ED throughput.
Yeah.
If it's not going to change what's going to be done, then it can be done as an inpatient.
In summary, it's like I'll use an MRI in a high-risk complaint in order to discharge the patient.
Absolutely.
You guys may be on the front of a, you know, a wave coming in, and it may be that 5-10 years from now when we can reduce some of the costs and also the time to do these studies, then maybe we'll all be doing it. But the reality is that it is so expensive in our setting. I'm not sure what you guys are charging. Every hospital is a little bit different. But, you know, to do some of these MRI studies are 2 and 3 times more than a CT scan.
I just can't fathom, for instance, going to an MRI of the pelvis and somebody with pelvic pain is my first diagnostic study.
We're just not there. And maybe we're behind, maybe we're kind of not the early adopters. So we'll see how that pans out. But at this stage in the evolution of MRI in the emergency department, as it applies to our setting, and I think probably most settings, it's very, very limited. And you really want to be selective about how you use it. And there are some pretty good uses for it, like the ones that we've described so far. And then there are, I think it's being overused. And the one study I do like is that limited wrist, because it's a short study. It takes like 10 minutes and it's fairly cheap, relatively. I think it's somewhere between $500 and $1,000 at our facility. And it will exclude a scaphoid fracture. When I have a kind of a moderate to high suspicion of a scaphoid fracture and I don't see it on the x-ray, in the right patient, I'll do that study so they don't have to be immobilized. But that might be a cost-benefit way to use it. But a musculoskeletal MRI otherwise.
No, that's fair. I don't do it myself.
Yeah.
I've never ordered one of those.
Well, a lot of people don't even know it exists because it's so new. I mean, this is such a new conversation.
I think there was, if I remember correctly, there was a little bit of talk about, you know, MRI perhaps being superior in a few of these, you know, clinical scenarios. And that may be the case, but a lot of these tests that we're talking about, CTs and ultrasounds, have pretty high sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have something that, you know, let's say might be 90% sensitive and another study that may be 94% sensitive, you know, clinically, those are fairly equivalent studies because I don't think that they really do a whole lot to alter your post-test probability when you have that incremental gain in sensitivity. So if you take something that, you know, is 75% sensitive and now goes to 95%, I'm interested.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ready for not even prime time.
It's like,
what's the opposite of prime time?
No, dude.
Like
downtime? Epic downtime. But I do want your residents to know that, you know, certainly they can be thought leaders and game changers in terms of emergency medicine practice, as residents should be when they come out into practice. But it's really not happening out there in the real world. I really admire you guys. You bite on some pretty big topics. I mean, what did we do last? It was like cardiac arrest. ACLS. Yeah. And then you guys did like PE. And then you guys, I think, did acute ischemic stroke and thrombolytics. And then you guys did, you guys are not afraid of tough topics. And I admire you for that. Diagnostic uncertainty
is a grand topic. It is the core of emergency medicine. It is every single day in the emergency department, you deal with diagnostic uncertainty. And if you're not comfortable with diagnostic uncertainty, you better get comfortable with it. Otherwise, it's going to be a long, tough road. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, you get much better at it as the years go on. You become more comfortable with it. Not everybody graduates from residency dialed in on diagnostic uncertainty. You will become more comfortable with it, but it is unequivocally a part of emergency medicine. We just don't have the time and the resources to get to the bottom of everything all the time.
Nor does medical science. Sometimes I think in our minds, based on the technology that we have surrounding us, in our minds, we think that we have a level of certainty available to us that I don't think it actually exists.
Patients certainly think that.
And I think that's a real core issue. A lot of people think that we have all the answers, that we can diagnose everything and treat everything and make everything better, but that is not the case. And it's amazing how many people really truly believe that. They watch too much House, Dr. House.
Exactly.
One of the characteristics of emergency medicine is such a broad field. We basically have to be good at everything, right? The fact is that we, as individuals, are good at a couple things. I think I'm good at a couple things. Maybe not, but I know for certain that I'm better at some things than others. And so every emergency physician is going to be better at certain some things than others. And so the uncertainty principle is going to be different for every individual practitioner.
The uncertainty, it's really difficult. And it's not just difficult to wrap your head around. It's difficult to explain to the patient.
Yeah.
It's difficult to chart. When you order all the tests, your medical decision-making is really easy. Mm-hmm. I did everything. The EKG was normal. The D-dimer was negative. The troponin was negative. And I admitted the patient. Like, the hard version is when there is uncertainty. You didn't do all the tests for whatever reason. You have to explain that to the reader and to the patient. And sometimes it's easier to test. And I use the example of the strep test. And, somebody comes in a triage, they got a sore throat, say the nurse gets a rapid strep, send it off to the lab, verbal order, it's back by the time you see the patient, you walk in there, you do a quick H&P, you don't have strep, the test is negative, we're going to discharge you home, you're going to be fine. That's an easy conversation to have, whereas the honest conversation is the strep test may only be 70% sensitive, and so there are false negatives and false positives, and there are carriers out there that are positive but don't really have the disease. And then even if you have strep, the risk of progressing to something more serious is much low or exceptionally low. We only treat this really rare complication called rheumatic fever that's essentially unheard of. We don't even know if things like peritonsillar abscesses can be prevented, and then there's side effects of antibiotics and allergic reactions and glomerulonephritis, and now you're just down the rabbit hole. And the patient is looking at you like, can I get out of here now?
Yeah.
Like,
antibiotics or no?
Yeah, exactly. It's easier sometimes just to do the test, but there are times when that is a bit intellectually dishonest.
Speaking of testing, I do want to talk about the background and sort of the mathematics and some of the philosophy of testing, because as a resident, I was super algorithmic, and you're just like getting into these kind of rhythms where you're like, oh, chest pain, da-da-da, abdominal pain, da-da-da. You get really algorithmic, and then you get more comfortable with stuff as you kind of progress through residency. But then when you're out as an attending, you go through a different type of evolution, which is much more philosophic. And you start to kind of see things from broader pictures, the whole system of healthcare delivery. You start to think about harm more. That's one thing that I've learned about more as an attending, really focusing on what hurts people and trying to avoid it, instead of like over-testing and just kind of throwing the whole kitchen sink at people. I do want to make a confession right off the bat, because I think this is relevant, and I think it's relevant to this entire conversation for every individual emergency physician. I'm a tester. Like, I work people up. I do more tests on average than my colleagues' average emergency medicine.
I agree. I am as well. I don't think I'm an outlier.
No, maybe not like a horrible standard deviations outlier, but I definitely am in the upper.
I don't order tests to cover my ass. I order tests because I worry about missing things.
Yeah, you too. And because I don't know why. That's how I am. That's me. And that's an important part of this conversation, is knowing who you are. The framework for the conversation of diagnostic uncertainty sort of comes down to testing in a way, because everything's a test, even a question at the bedside, right? A physical exam finding. Everything is a test, and it has a test characteristics. Some of this is encapsulated in the so-called like Fagan nomogram. And this is sort of a mathematical relationship between the pretest probability or the prevalence, the test characteristics of whatever test you're going to apply that to, and how, and the post-test probability that is a result. It's basically a logarithmic representation of the product of your pretest probability and your likelihood ratio. The point being is that there are three ingredients to this equation. One is your pretest probability, also known as Gestalt. The other is likelihood ratio. If you're going to order a test or apply a test, you know, history or a question, you have to kind of know how that test operates. And most of the tests that we use routinely have been studied to some extent. And that brings up the second more important ingredient of the equation, which is the pretest probability. Because pretest probability and Gestalt, or whatever you want to call it, that is the crux. And that relies on a lot of things that are time sensitive and training, level of training sensitive, level of years you've been out, number of patients you've seen, number of cases you've seen. It's so difficult to quantify. And the example I always use, you know, the mathematics of D-dimer for excluding PE. So if you have a pretest probability of 15% and the likelihood ratio of D-dimer is, I think, 0.2 or whatever, depending on the study, you know, the negative likelihood ratio, then your posterior probabilities are less than 2% or in that zone, and you don't have to do any more testing. If you jack up your pretest probability to 50% and your likelihood ratio, your negative likelihood ratio is 0.2, then your posterior probability, it's on the order of 5%. And that may be acceptable too. So that's why some people will use D-dimers for moderate pretest probability. But if you start jacking your pretest probability up to 80%, 60%, you know, in that zone, then your D-dimer with a negative likelihood ratio of 0.2, the posterior probability is now 20% or 40%, and that's not adequate. And that's the good example that we always teach residents, and we've all been taught, you can't use a D-dimer if you have a high pretest probability.
More importantly, and certainly more relevant to emergency medicine, is the opposite scenario. When you take somebody who has a very low pretest probability and you apply a test to them, it's going to do very little to modify or to influence your posterior probability. This concept is key because that's what we do in the emergency department most of the time. You know, when we get positive tests, we know what to do. We take care of that. Most of what we do is rule things out and send people home. If you got somebody coming in with pelvic pain and you're working them up for cyst or torsion, for example, and you get an ultrasound and it shows good flow and their pain is well controlled and they don't have historical elements highly suggestive of torsion, then you're done with a negative ultrasound. On the other hand, if the patient's clinical history is suggestive of a torsion or the mythical intermittent torsion, colicky coming and going, it's not getting better in the ED, then yeah, then your ultrasound, your negative ultrasound is not enough. And you might go on to a diagnostic study like an MRI that might have incremental improvement in test characteristics. So it all depends on your pretest probability. And frankly, it doesn't matter what the radiologist says in their read. If on the ultrasound read they say, recommend MRI as it is more sensitive for torsion, you say, duly noted, my patient doesn't have characteristics that are suggestive of torsion. I'm going to treat her empirically as a cyst. She has a small cyst on her ultrasound. Her pain is well controlled. I'm going to give her return precautions. But it all depends on the pretest probability.
That's kind of how this so-called like Bayesian, you know, Fagan nomogram approach works mathematically. But how do you quantify and how do you formulate a pretest probability? We don't have a number. You know, you don't walk up to a patient and do a history and physical and say, oh, their pretest probability of cholecystitis is 37%. There's so many moving parts, and it has to do with so many moving factors. How busy is your department? How much time can you spend at the bedside? What's your background with this particular presentation? Some people are really good at cardiology. Some people are really good at ortho. Some people are good at neuro. Some emergency physicians are really good at urology. But, you know, the fact is that everybody's a little different. Every patient's different. And you, as an individual practitioner, have to be very careful about the pretest probability or the gestalt in terms of, like, how predictive it is.
Early on, it is helpful to use calculators and scores.
Decision instruments.
I think most emergency physicians overestimate the pretest probability in general.
Agree.
If you look at a Wells score, you'd be surprised what is moderate. Most emergency physicians would be peeing their pants with a moderate risk Wells score patient trying to rush them to CT scan.
It's true.
But as you go on, you're not going to be using those numbers anymore, and you're
just becomes so.
You walk out of the room and you're like, "There's nothing going on with
that
guy."
So intangible.
Or there's something going on with that guy.
The example of the kid. Okay, middle of flu season, RSV season. You got a refugee camp in the waiting room. Everybody's got cold, sniffles, and fevers. And you walk in the room. And there's a 2-year-old there. They're presenting with a fever and a cold and sniffles. And you walk in the room and you look at the patient from the door. And the first thing out of your mouth is, "Get a blood sugar." There's something. There's something unusual about the way this child is looking.
Never ignore that little voice in the back of your head.
The gut feeling. What I'm getting at is the crux of the equation is the pretest probability in Gestalt, because it's all over the place. And if you have a patient who's got a high squirrel titer, which is coined by one of our partners, you know that patient that you just can't get a meaningful history from, whether it's psych or tox or ETOH or combination of the above. If you can't formulate that, and whether you're too busy to spend the time at the bedside to actually get, I mean, I hate to say that. I know it's not really good medicine, but sometimes you go eyeball people, and we all do it. And if that's the case, then you need to recognize that. And these are all influences on your gestalt. If you're not digging into the details and really developing a pretest probability, or you haven't seen that case a bunch of times, then you have to be cognizant of that.
When you can't formulate that really highly developed pretest probability or gestalt, you're just following algorithms.
Yeah.
You're following a cookbook. And when you can, then you can make these decisions to omit and forgo tests. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. But when you do have a highly developed ability to risk stratify these patients in your mind, you're going to forgo these tests.
Gestalt is a time-sensitive process. It can't be rushed. It can't be, you cannot expect a young junior attending who hasn't seen a ton of patients to have the same gestalt as Ken Iserson. Let me just use me as an example. When I graduated from residency, I admitted a lot of patients. We admitted a lot of patients in residency, you know, or at least I did, you know, and my attending seemed to be okay with that. but we admitted a lot of people, and obviously there's acuity variations and stuff. But when I came here, I admitted a lot of patients. I was in the top couple of people in the group in terms of admit rates. Now, I have cut my personal, 5 years later, or I guess I'm on my sixth year as an attending in solo practice, and my admit rate has been cut in half. And it's an interesting question. Why is that?
I think it's because 10% of your patients die in the ED.
That's true.
So you don't have to admit them.
But I don't even count those ones. Those ones aren't even included. It's a process. And I'm trying, the illustration is that it doesn't mean I was a bad doctor when I graduated from residency. It means I didn't have the ability or the experience or the gestalt or the bedside, you know, Jedi skills to make these decisions. I mean, I'm so much more comfortable with uncertainty that I send half of those patients home that I would have previously admitted 5 years ago.
Absolutely.
And that's the process.
You can't be expected to be a Jedi at the start, but you will get there. You know, when the stakes are high, you can't be uncertain. Probably goes without saying, but it's important to recognize that you know, you can't have a lot of uncertainty when it comes to things like MI and stroke. You really need to have more certainty when it comes to those more critical diagnoses. I think in the emergency department, you need to get exceptionally comfortable with empiric treatment. I use that word in my charting all the time. I'm going to treat empirically for this. I've just decided to treat empirically for this. Empiric treatment in the emergency department, it goes hand in hand with this uncertainty that we deal with every day. Sometimes you have to decide when to pull the trigger, and every case is different. It depends on the consequences. It depends on your pretest probability. But at some point in time, if the test isn't going to tell you anything further, or if there is no test that's going to give you any useful information, you just have to decide to treat, and you need to be
the road.
You need to become comfortable with that, and you need to become comfortable explaining that to your patients. Diagnostic uncertainty, you know, goes hand in hand with sitting down and talking to your patients.
It's the only remedy, the only solution to the dilemma, because the dilemma of diagnostic uncertainty is not going anywhere. I don't care if we get a damn Star Trek tricorder, you know, or whatever diagnostic test that's coming next, or, you know, the ProCal, whatever's coming, it's never going to replace the absolute necessity of actually having that conversation with the patient and getting good at it. That's the most important part of being an attending, is you get good at communicating. You learn tactics of how to, like, connect with people and make them understand what you're worried about.
I'm a big fan of shared decision making, whether it's ordering tests, you know, how long they want to stay in the emergency department, admission versus discharge, and, you know, sitting down and talking to your patients. It goes a long way in remedying things like dissatisfaction. I know for a fact that, you know, from personal experience and talking to colleagues, like, just because you give more pain meds doesn't mean that your pain scores are going to be better. And just because you order more tests doesn't mean your patient satisfaction scores are going to be better. There are patients who are not going to hear otherwise, and you're going to cave every once in a while and do tests, and that's normal.
Yep,
we all. But in general, I don't think that we do a lot of tests just because people expect it.
I think that we comfort ourselves.
I used to think that.
You kind of use it as a scapegoat, I think, in some ways. Like, because we feel so pressured in so many other different ways that we're going to blame it on, you know, press gainy or whatever, because there's some expectations of us. And it's not false. It's just, I think, a little bit of a misrepresentation.
It's hard when you're young and somewhat inexperienced to have that confidence to say to the patient, I don't think there's anything going on here. I don't think you need these tests. You can go home. And so that self-confidence, you know, is going to make you a better explainer and a better communicator, and your patients are inherently going to be more satisfied.
I thought it was a very fascinating concept that Chris brought up. I'm not an attending and I'm not teaching residents, so I'm not, I'm not like responsible for the next generation of doctors like you guys are. I mean, that's a pretty big responsibility, I think. And when you said, I don't want to teach residents to be afraid, I want to teach them confidence, or how do I teach young emergency medicine learners how to be comfortable with uncertainty? Because it's a difficult thing to teach, I think. It's very easy, on the other hand, to teach someone to be afraid. This is just a purely an observation of my own process. Like when I came out of residency, I think that I felt a lot of fear. I felt a lot of anxiety. And I think, like, within somewhere implicitly embedded in my, or even sometimes explicitly embedded in my emergency medicine training, I think there is some fear that's in there, because we see bad stuff. We see bad outcomes. We have patients that we see who look well, who come back and have horrible outcomes. And if you're in the ED for long enough, you're going to have that happen to you. So fear, I think, is part of this whole equation. And what Chris said is so interesting to me, because if you wanted to set up some sort of like curriculum to teach residents to be comfortable with uncertainty, you'd have to completely abandon the strategies that we use to teach medicine. This is not science. This is like ethnography. It's like psychology and like recognizing heuristics and decision making. And what kind of person are you? Are you a risk taker? Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable with uncertainty yourself, like in other parts of your life? And everybody's different. So everybody's going to kind of fall along this continuum. And there's no way you're ever going to be able to squeeze all the emergency physicians into some sort of like normalized testing, you know, treating pattern, because everybody's so different.
I think it's an incredibly difficult thing to teach.
I don't even know how
to do you it. Teach comfort with diagnostic uncertainty? It only comes with experience and seeing a lot of cases. But you certainly can, you know, teach fear or the lack thereof.
Yeah.
It's really easy to instill fear. I mean, that's a universal emotion that we all understand.
Yeah. It's emphasized in emergency medicine because most of us are going to miss stuff.
You have to have respect for this. Don't get me wrong. You have to have respect. You can't be paralyzed by that fear. Like, you got to move on. You got to make a decision.
The last thing I do want to touch on is this concept of money, because this is becoming just such a prevalent topic. It's trendy to do less. It's like less is good. The doctor who does the fewest tests is like the coolest. It's like a popularity contest. Physician utilization sort of reviews and physician utilization data, it's coming our way. You know, it's kind of the next sort of rollout of some of the ACA stuff. And, you know, certainly you guys are talking about getting these sort of scatter plots from your department.
Just like the whole medical legal fear thing, you know, you can't let that influence your state of mind on a day-to-day basis. You know, you have to come to grips that some people order tests and some people don't.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be an outlier. If you're an outlier, then there is a problem. Yeah. You know, if you're doing something that 50% of the time that everyone else is doing 10% of the time, then that needs to be addressed. Don't get too hung up because you happen to order a few more tests than your colleagues, and it's just your style. And as long as it's consistent, you're doing a good thing, you're doing good work, doing right by the patient, that's all that really matters.
This is a bit of a pet peeve of mine, so you have to forgive me, and maybe I'm completely off base here. Luckily, you guys don't get a chance to peer review me. But this whole thing about like, oh, CBCs are useless, and BMP versus a CMP, and oh, why are you getting a lipase? I get it. If you don't need to get labs, don't get labs. Yeah. If you're going to get labs, I mean, don't pinch pennies over should I get a basic or a comprehensive. If you really want to like impact resource stewardship, you want to send people home. You want to discharge people from, you want to keep people out of the hospital. And I'll give you like a perfect example of my own sort of life is like the elderly. Because when I was a young attending and a resident, it was like I'd see an 85-year-old hit the board, and regardless of their complaint, they had at least an 85% chance of getting admitted. And nowadays, when I see elderly people in the ED, I walk in the room and the first thing on my mind is I am discharging this patient unless I have to admit them, because this is a very select patient population who does horribly as an inpatient. They have tons of inpatient complications. They disproportionately have adverse events in the hospital. They do better at home. If you want to be a resource steward, sure, you want to be cognizant about how many imaging studies you're doing, and you want to be cognizant about the testing you're ordering, and you certainly want to consider money, because money is up in our grill in the healthcare system in the US. And I am not saying that that's not an important topic, but I do want to just kind of put it into a little perspective. Because if you can do an MRI and rule out a TIA and send a patient home, that's money well spent, because being in the hospital for that time is way more expensive and more dangerous for the patient. Learn about outpatient management, learn how to take care of these patients, learn how to sit down at the bedside and formulate a plan with the patient, do the extra work, do the extra charting. I know it's a pain in the ass, but send people home as much as you possibly can, because that's going to help the healthcare system much more than, like, what should I get, a CMP or a BMP? We really appreciate the invitation to chat here. This is a huge topic. I know that we've been a little bit circuitous, and we tried to address a couple of the concepts. You guys did a fantastic job sort of summarizing and choosing how to arrange this kind of conversation, because in my mind, it's difficult to even approach it. It's certainly a fascinating part of it. It's more of like a anthropology, you know, of physicians in some regards, and psychology and stuff that we don't really have a lot of background in. So it's a really fascinating topic, and we appreciate the chance to come and chat about it. And we also want to say we love the podcast. It just gets better every month. You guys have nailed some huge topics, really taught me a lot. Really appreciate everything you guys are doing.
Absolutely. Keep doing a good job. Keep doing good work. And we really appreciate the opportunity to be involved.
Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man.
With everything that we have at our disposal now, we have coming up MRIs that are going to be more readily available. We have RNA biosignatures that are going to start to identify exactly the virus or exactly the bacteria in 2 to 4 hours instead of waiting for cultures. I mean, there's a test for anything that you want if you're willing to wait long enough. But for us in the ER, what we've discussed is that you can't make all those decisions for every single person per se, and you have to use some risk stratification. So we were eager to hear your perspective on how you deal with diagnostic uncertainty in the emergency department, specifically where it relates to advanced imaging.
Well, I think we need to step back and look at the process of making decisions in the emergency department, because it's quite different from the inpatient service, be it internal medicine, pediatrics, or any of the surgical specialties. So how is it different, and how does it affect our decision making? It's different because if you start looking for a specific disease, you're going to make trouble for yourself. And the reason that we get so anxious about having diagnostic certainty is because we haven't gone through the mental logic of emergency medicine decision making, and because you can't prove a negative. So what is the correct logic? The correct logic is to not look for a specific disease. Your first tasks in emergency medicine are to measure the degree of difficulty of the next dive, if you will. Well, how sick is this patient? Is the patient dying is the first question. There are only a finite small number of ways you die, maybe 4, okay? Is the patient on one of those pathways? And if the patient is, what do I have to do to get him off the pathway? Secondly, if the patient is not on a pathway to death, how sick is this patient? Is this a patient who looks and is probably so ill that they're going to require inpatient treatment? And And then and only then can you start asking questions about how did they get here? Because the third most important question is, what's different today? What changed for this patient that made them come to the emergency department? It might be something as simple as time of day. A little illness in a child that's tolerable in the daytime becomes very scary at night, and added to having put up with it for many hours, can't tolerate it any longer. But that's still useful information in terms of how much anxiety are you going to have about this patient if you don't know the precise diagnosis. So that's number one. Number two, we're looking for diagnostic certainty via a logic that is inherently flawed from commencement. And that is, we have to use Bayesian logic about medical decision making. And Bayesian logic is, if there's not a high prior probability of the disease that you're looking for in the population that in which you're looking for it, there is no biologic test that performs with accuracy, be it an imaging study, be it a laboratory study. You only get false positives and false negatives, along with true information, and it's very hard to set out, but in terms of diagnostic certainty, it prevents it. The second thing is, even if we can remember the logic of how accurate any single test is, what we forget is, what is the value of the evidence of the test? For example, one of our major problems is ischemic coronary syndrome. Now, 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, the problem wasn't ischemic coronary syndrome, it was heart attack. For some reason, the awareness of what was a heart attack hadn't been codified, and we were struggling with doing it accurately. I think that the biologic tests for heart attack have now become helpful because we have a high prior probability in the population we're studying. So that's no longer the right question. The right question is not, is this patient having a heart attack? Because that's an easy yes-no answer today. But the tough question is this patient having an ischemic coronary syndrome? And sub-question A, if the patient is, then what do I need to do for it? And that's what leads to the diagnostic uncertainty. If we're comfortable diagnostically that the patient is having an ischemic coronary syndrome, we're not comfortable without an institutional protocol of what to do for that entity. And it varies from institution to institution. Inside some institution, it varies from cardiologist to cardiologist or primary care physician. And so we end up not feeling exactly sure what to do for the patient and thinking that yet another test will help us. So we move from our standard workup of acute coronary syndrome to coronary CT angiogram. And what we forget is, even if we move to the cath lab and do a specific coronary angiogram, we still end up with diagnostic uncertainty because there's no good rules and certainly no good evidence for which is the culprit vessel. And what the emergency physician doesn't see is that many patients get vessels stented that don't need to because they have a positive imaging study. So is it a false positive? Well, not in the usual sense of false positive. It's false positive in the sense that we don't know how to look at an imaging study and say this is what the disease is that's causing the patient's symptomatology. It's kind of like looking at a pneumothorax on a plain chest x-ray study. We don't know what the degree of pneumothorax is, even though we tend to put a number to it. We don't know what the pathophysiology is, whether we're dealing with tension pneumothorax. And all of the indirect findings that imaging gives us doesn't answer that question. It's a clinical question that can't be answered by an image. I think we need to go back away from feeling that if I have an image that is read as an X, then I'm dealing with an X, and that's diagnostic certainty. Lastly, we fool ourselves because we concern ourselves with a disease that probably isn't there, but we don't want to miss it. And then when we don't find it, we breathe a sigh of relief and we tell the patient, great, you don't have gallbladder disease. Well, the patient didn't think he had gallbladder disease in the first place and still wants to know why his stomach hurts. And often we overlook that because we now move back to the position that this patient looks okay to us and we're happy that we've reached diagnostic certainty about gallstones, and we forget there's a zillion other entities that could be the culprit. So I think what we really need to start teaching is not so much how do I get people to order fewer tests and fewer imaging studies, but what's the quality of the evidence that we're going to get from any individual test? How is it going to alter my management of this patient? And if I can't answer that question, do I need that evidence?
I tell the residents a fair amount that one of the things that they need to consider is reassurance is one of the main reasons people come to the ER. They just want to know everything's okay. And there are those patients where they're reassured because somebody dressed like a physician has told them good news. It's not dangerous. And that can be accomplished with a history and physical. And they feel fine and want to know when they can go. And then there's other patients that say, well, how do you know? You haven't even done any tests. And so their trust is not placed in you. It's placed in the test. Even though they don't realize it's your interpretation of the test, or a radiologist's interpretation of the test that's actually going to determine it. They have this kind of belief in an all-infallible test that's going to let them know yes or no. How much weight do you put in the patient's desire for a testing modality to help relieve their diagnostic uncertainty?
I've perhaps encountered less of that than the present generation, because I practiced for a long time before we had the tests. And so I got used to communicating my opinion of disease to the patient more than what the test showed. I have had patients who simply have to have a study. There's something magical about having endured some x-rays that they can't go without. And frankly, I don't have the energy to fight with them. I don't think it's worth it. There are limits that I can set for myself. If a patient asked me to do a brain transplant, I would have no problem telling him, no, I'm not going to do that because it's A, not possible, and B, it's a silly idea for what's wrong with you. But if a patient wants a CAT scan for a kidney stone, and I know they've got one, I don't mind getting one for them because it isn't going to alter what I do for the patient. And I think part of that solution is we want to be reassuring to patients, but at the same time, we want to tell them what's wrong. This is how long it's going to be wrong. This is what you have to do to get better. This is how long it's going to take you to get better. And this is what you look for if you're not getting better. And this is what you do if you don't get better. In other words, we need to redesign our discharge instructions so that they're useful and they're more like a set of post-op orders than they are like a set of legal cover my ass because I know I've made a diagnostic error. So I agree with you. I think reassurance is significant, and I think that every patient comes to the emergency department with fear. Every patient is afraid of some diagnosis that they think they're having. And part of our job is to find out what is that fear and try to alleviate it.
Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am.